Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
How's your con going?
Yes.
Good.
Good.
Yes, how's
We're
your
just
con
waking
going?
Up.
Yes.
We just had coffee.
Oh, really?
Are you a West Coaster?
We stumbled through our first session yesterday.
Yeah, we are late-rising people here in the Sunset Land, so trust me, the panels will probably get even better as the day goes on and we wake up. If we could host them at midnight, they would be off the hook.
Is that why Academy's going first?
They tried that, recordings were made, it won't be tried again.
Bad idea.
Do you want to lead us off, Owen? Did you propose this? Whose panel is this?
I don't know.
Would you like to moderate?
Sure.
Okay.
Hi, welcome to Enhanced Gaming. We're going to talk about making your gaming sessions richer and more fun and more tactile with props and other things you can do that aren't just dice and paper and pencils.
aren't we discussing Pathfinder Academy in this room?
Yes.
Oh,
that's what my schedule said.
No.
Nice. Olympic 3.
Enhanced gaming using props effectively.
Olympic 3.
Yes.
Olympic 3.
Yes. We are in the correct room. If you are here for Pathfinder Academy, you are not in the correct room.
Where are we supposed to be? Because it says... It says 3.
Yeah, it says 3. Right across the hall.
Okay.
What does the book say, Jess?
I'm looking. I'm trying to find Pathfinder Academy. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Oh! Oh, that's a 2.
2?
Yeah.
No,
it's at 2.
It's
at 2.
It's at 2.
You need a little more coffee.
You are an hour early.
Our tickets say 1 to 2.
Oh, dear.
That's happened to a lot of people lately.
That's maybe there. Oh, there's a ticket misprint.
Well,
sorry
bye.
About that.
We still love you.
Wait. Wait.
Keely, quick, to the window.
Turn around.
Okay. Okay, so
a masquerade ticket that's got the wrong time on the invitation now.
Thanks. Okay, so now that the riffraff have left, we've come on with our panel. Why don't we start out by telling about our favorite prop or
that's a great idea.
Experience? You can start.
Okay.
Time to think
My favorite prop experience involved professional props, and we will discuss whether or not they have to be professional. But many, many, many years ago, indicating how old I am, Chaosium put out a Miskatonic University student starter kit, which was actually a list of class schedules and a Go Fighting Cephalopod bumper sticker and a map of campus. And it's about 32 pages with a bunch of extras. And a GM was running a game I was in, took our characters to Miskatonic University just for part of the adventure, and he bought one of these kits for each of us, and he had used it to set up the plot. So when we were trying to figure out, you got to go talk to this professor, he's running geology, we can be like, geology, where's geology? And it meant that rather than doing everything as a single map, each of us were able to look at things on our own and read background information and ask questions. It gave us all a common frame of reference, but it also caused us all to think things like when we were going to a bar to try and find someone, we're like, well, we don't know who here's from Miskatonic University. Wait, do any of them have a bumper sticker on the back of their car? Because my game came with a bumper sticker. And so by using those tools as part of the plot line and giving them to physical, tangible objects, one of the things is there was no note-taking we had to take, right? He doesn't have to tell us, here are 47 classes, and we're all desperately writing them down. We had all that information. But he'd also looked at everything in that introductory kit for new students, and built the plot around it so that we had this common frame of reference of this imaginary place. And that made that series of 4 or 5 adventures based in that area be very memorable, obviously, because it was like 20 or 40 years ago, and move very smoothly despite being very information intensive because we had these props that had a lot of the information encoded in them.
Cool. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Now he's like,
oh shoot! Yeah, it's always a little difficult to follow Owen after he has told a story of any kind. A friend of ours, mine, this guy here too, but he had his own homebrew of a weird Wild West setting. It's kind of a lot like Deadlands. But what he had for props, and he would bring them out, and we would just have them for the entire game, would be a bunch of cowboy hats. Nice ones, too, not like cheap plastic ones you get from the party store or something like that.
As is proper.
As is proper. And he had replica firearms. So you could, you know, you'd have the hat on, you could be holding the gun, you'd get the heft of the weight, and like, oh, this is the thing I'm going to try to shoot somebody with now. But then you could also be really cool and you could sit back at the table, have your hat over your head, you know, just hat over your eyes, and then just, like, pick up the gun. Like, yep. You better smoke that skin wagon. Skin that smoke wagon.
Yeah.
It is a thing. You saw it.
One is
I got one is filthy. One is filthy. The other is a quote from Tombstone, which we just watched the other night. Skin that smoke wagon. Yeah, you could have just woken up. My mouth strikes again.
You got your new innuendo for the day.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Yeah, they ignore me.
In mere moments. Yeah.
No, dang it! Dang it, y'all. So anyway, that, you know, having physical things like that definitely puts you in a certain frame of mind.
Oh.
That's it. Besides the filthiness, that's it.
I have two stories from the same game. One about the props that I intentionally made ahead of time, and the other about the props that I was forced to make. So I ran a game, a bunch of first-time players, and the idea was I was going to start them out in a setting that would make sense to people who are not terribly familiar with the conventions of role-playing games. That is, a school for adventurers. I'm like, it's a little bit like Hogwarts, and they're like, oh, okay. So the idea was the game was going to start out in their last week of classes there, and their graduation exercise was going to be going to this cave nearby and clearing out this kobold infestation, right? So I've made, you know, a beautiful map of the school, and that's it. So my players are like, okay, well, like, are classes over, or, like, we still have classes? And, like, and I stupidly, I'm like, no, you're like, you're just finishing up your classes. And they're like, oh, what classes are we taking? And I'm like, give me a moment. So I make some crap up, right? I list a few classes, and they're like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Like, can we roleplay going to that class? And I'm like, don't you want to go outside and see the lovely surprise I've prepared for you? Do you want to go outside for their song? They're like, no, like, we wanna roleplay this. And I'm like, okay, so stupidly, because I was a first-time GM, right? I'm like, all right, we do some stuff, and like, I will have more information for you on this next time. And they're like, okay. So I make up syllabi. Well, that was a mistake because then they wanted readings. And I'm from the Midwest. I'm really bad at saying no. So I made them some readings. 13 sessions later, they finally went out the door for the first time. We've basically been playing Harry Potter the RPG for, you know, 13 weeks. I went home for the holidays and they wanted to play online because they didn't want to miss their classes.
They didn't realize it wasn't in real time, right?
No, but okay. I mean, they wanted, you know, then they wanted a test. I used it to teach them a lot of, like, basics about spellcasting, right? Stuff they needed to know, a lot of world history, all that, but, you know, it ended up being probably as much work as teaching a real college course. I wrote up fake academic papers with footnotes. They wrote papers citing those papers. There was a lot of paper. So anyway, finally I got them to go outside and attempted to lock the doors of the school behind them. But one of them was a rogue. She rolled really well in her lockpicking, so they did go back inside. But anyway, I learned very important lessons about, like, don't make props that suggest other props unless you want to also have to make those props. On the other hand, I had prepared later in the campaign for them to go to the opera, and I had created a soundtrack, right, with the audience noises and the orchestra warming up, and, you know, a bunch of arias, and the intermission during which they were supposed to find this guy who was in a box seat and talk to him and get some information, and I'd make programs, and this went really well, but I will never do it again. Like, they still talk about it. But the thing is, when you have a soundtrack where certain things have to happen coordinated with the sound, mm-hmm. when you're asking people to, like, roll a perception check, you end up being like, roll it, and faster! Because, you know, otherwise you miss the moment. But the other thing that happened was before they went to the opera, they wanted to go shopping for opera clothes. So, yeah, that didn't involve any props, but, you know. Well, I mean, you know, I was like, well, we are going to go to the real opera that I'm dragging you to, so we could actually go shopping, but we're not going to roleplay while we do it because that would be weird. But anyway, so the programs, they all kept, they still mention that, they still like, have their programs, one of them has it framed with some of the other ephemera from the campaign and this little shadow box thing, and so like having that tactile piece that, you know, is those something that you use because they needed to know when a particular piece of music was coming up. and that becomes a really nice souvenir. So that can be really powerful. But don't make props that suggest other props unless you're writing for that.
And I think we can, in fact, spin that out a little bit. That think about the benefit you're getting from the prop versus the amount of effort you put into it. She was talking about music and how hard it is to coordinate things. She's absolutely right. My wife is also a gamer, and she is smarter and more creative than I am, so a lot of my examples are going to be things she did instead of things I did, because she's smarter and more creative than I am. She was running a Supernatural game in Cortex. Is anyone here a fan of the show Supernatural? Anyone? No one? Great. Well, okay. This is a better story if you are. And she had a Zune, again, I'm dating myself, with 1,000 modern rock songs on it that she had on Scramble, and she had every player select a song on that was our theme song. In my case, I was playing a supernatural hunter who was a Mennonite on Rumspringa with a silvered hammer, literally. And so Missionary Man was that character's theme song. If that came on, I got an extra hero point. If Carry On Wayward Son came on, everyone gets an extra hero point. As a result, she didn't have to time anything. If the song came on and it's your theme song, you notice. She didn't even have to remember what they were. We did, in fact, have, over a year or so long campaign, one moment where we were getting ourselves significantly beaten up. Trying to keep it PG. It was going poorly, and we are all out of hero points. And we're, like, literally hanging our head. I have no idea how we are going to survive this encounter. Beat. First string of Carry On Wayward Son. Everyone gets a hero point. Suddenly we've got options. We can do something. Now, the timing of that worked out well, but we only remember that because that's the moment where it really mattered. Songs came on all the time. It turns out if you game for 12 hours, 1,000 songs goes by a lot faster than you think. But that's a case where it was actually very little effort. We had the list of songs. She just said, this happens when this occurs. So the songs were still part of the campaign. They were an important part of it. You're listening for your theme song. And also, when she was running, if your theme song came on, sort of the entire scene focused on you for a minute, because that's your theme song. So there was spotlight kind of built into it. So you can take an idea that might have worked out poorly and think, what can we do for that prop? What elements of that do people enjoy that we can then repurpose and make less impact, not slow down the game, add rather than distract to the total experience.
And in fact, later, I don't remember when it is, but I'm going to be on a panel with Ben Loomis from Sirenscape. We're going to talk about opera a lot, because we always end up doing that for some reason every time we sit at the table together. But in his case, his attempts to use pre-recorded music with his game and the difficulties in managing timing with that caused him to go create an entire app that's really great and gets around a lot of those problems. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm excited. I have nothing else to say about that.
I just looked at you. But.
Yeah, music. I agree. Like, I don't have any sort of like mechanical effects for that sort of thing. But we did do a campaign in which they had everyone pick a theme song, but it was just like we just kind of had it on in the background so people can know, like, oh, this is my song. Or like, oh, we can just fast forward to the one song that's when someone's doing something awesome. I have a different track to take here besides away from music.
Yeah.
You can, one of the things that's sort of like, I guess, a big known secret about GMing is feel free to steal other things.
Oh, yeah.
So if you need to essentially steal bits from another game to make your game better, you should be doing that, right? This is not my story, but I was just talking to Joe Pacini, who said what he did was he was running, you know, Pathfinder, but they got to a point where they were about to cross a bridge, and so what he did was, okay, everyone put your character sheets away, here's Jenga Tower. We're going to play, if you're all familiar with it, the indie game Dread, which is basically pull on Jenga Tower. So that like, everyone suddenly focus on the tension, crossing rickety bridge. People are really worried. I mean, it will stretch out a small scene like crossing a bridge to maybe a whole session, but it's a very memorable session when it happens. So you can do, you know, borrow other games from other RIDs from other games. I have real backwards words today. Stuff like that.
In fact, you can use props and elements from other games to make a skill check. So oftentimes, we represent doing really complex stuff in-game via a simple die roll, right? Like interpreting, translating an ancient text in an ancient language is not a simple or quick thing, right? And so, like, for people who are not particularly, I was going to say geeky, but for whom that is not their particular avenue of geekdom, the fact that they can represent whether or not they have succeeded at it with a die roll and just be done is, you know, often a positive. But if you have people who want to engage with that and want to feel like they're actually doing what they're doing by their roles, instead of just making a linguistics check, you can use a cipher, right, to approximate that task of translating, you know, a substitution cipher with finding the Sunday paper, right? Give them the document with the information they need in that cipher. And it's also a way that it also allows everybody to participate in a way that just one character making a die roll doesn't. So if you want to flesh things out that people feel like they're actually doing the work of accomplishing something.
And I think that touches on a whole category that can be very, very successful, and that's puzzles.
Yeah.
Puzzles can be a great prop to introduce to a game. I was playing in a game where a big part of the plot was that we were trying to assemble an ancient tablet on which there was a ritual we needed to perform. And that is sort of the 20-game overplot. And so we were going to different places and dealing with different groups and hunting them down, killing them and taking their stuff. And their stuff frequently included parts of this tablet. But it's not like the tablet comes with instructions. So the first time we did that, the game master gave us a homemade jigsaw puzzle piece. He had just taken a piece of cardstock, he'd written out in plain English what we needed to do, and he cut it up. We were like, this isn't that complicated, but we get to physically keep it, we get to see what kind of progress we're making, we get to decide, do these look like this line is all written in one row, so even though we're missing the middle, we can figure it out. And of course, we were trying to put it together in between games. One of the things about it being in between games was that we would get together and talk about it, but it's not the action of the game. It gave us something to do outside of the game that didn't slow the game down, but made it a very tactile experience for us. And so we had, you can get roll-on post-it note material that turns anything into a post-it note, so we had simply taken a whiteboard and we started to put them up on there. And of course, if you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, you start with the corners. So we get, in the first five or six pieces, we have four corners. We're like, great, we got four corners. And then, when we finished our next mission, we had a quarter. And we realized that we're getting things that aren't part of this tablet, that we have misidentified as part of the tablet.
Nice.
And so now, when we're getting towards the end, we get to decide when we perform this ritual. This ritual is in plain English. We're missing at least five or six pieces. We don't think these are them. So maybe we know, so we got to decide when do we have enough information that we're willing to make a guess. And the way the ritual works, it's like, you know, walk in a circle three times, light two torches, and say the following words. It was a simple ritual. So all we had to do is tell the ref, these are the actions we're going to take. There was no skill check there. It was, do we, the players, think that we have the information to do this? So instead of make an int check and do a ritual, it was just, here it is, tell me what you're going to do when you're going to do it. We actually got really paranoid and waited until we were missing one piece before we were willing to say, well, we know none of these are it because they don't go there. We're pretty sure that word must be torch because it's missing a word, O-R-C-H. That's got to be torch. We'll do it. But that carried over a number of games. And even a simple jigsaw puzzle, early on, it's hard to tell where things go. So we were... It was in our hands to make the game. A Jenga tower comes close to the same thing, right? It's not exactly a puzzle, but you have to decide, how are we using this? I have seen games that use slider blocks where you've got 16 spaces and one spot missing and you got to get them in order. You can buy those for like 25 cents that are plastic and blank, have it where you want it, write a rune on it, scramble it up, and then give it to them like, here are your various options. It is important to find out what kinds of puzzles do your players enjoy? This is a place where I think it's very useful to know your players with a prop. I mean, if you've got the skills and the time and the money and you're going to make the actual crown of the king with the four missing gems and you're going to take that to a con and people get to put the gems in, they'll get something out of that. But for the simpler stuff, it really is helpful to know what are your players into, what do they enjoy. My wife loves crossword, or she loves crossword puzzles, but jigsaw puzzles. So that is why that ref picked that element, and she was the keeper of them, and we were trusting her to make those decisions.
Also make sure that if you're going to invest a lot of time creating a prop, that it's something you enjoy doing, right? Like, because they do take a lot of time, and you can't always control how fast your players solve puzzles, so there's always the chance that they will solve it in, like, 5 seconds, and if you spent days laboring over that thing, I did something similar to what Owen's GM did, except instead of it just being, like, paper, I made a clay tablet. I inscribed in it a language that I had created for them to interpret it. I ceased to enjoy it halfway through, although the part where I descended the stairs into the fire escape stairs in my apartment building, into the cement-floored little hallway, and like Moses descending the mountain and smashed the tablet so that they could, you know, reassemble the pieces. That part was deeply satisfying, but making it was not. So make sure if you're going to do something complicated that it's something you actually enjoy doing.
Yeah, and you can tailor what you like to do to add something to your game. So maybe you're not creative enough to want to bake a tablet or make a jigsaw puzzle,
but you can still smash them.
You can still smash them up. Feel free to smash them up. But maybe what your passion is cooking or baking, and so you can maybe one night make a meal for your group, and then like, oh, this is the part where we have the feast with the king, and then you go, whoa, I've got right here plant or big ham, or you know, just like you go to the elven tower. And get, yeah, it's a bunch of bread. You know, here's your rations and stuff like that. Where really, sort of like, if it's something you enjoy, you'll enjoy doing it, and it won't be a chore to do it for your group. And then it'll also make your group have a really good time, or alcoholic drinks.
I am trying so hard, and I've been trying for 5 years, and I promise you, I will keep trying to get cocktails blurring on the schedule.
But that kind of stuff can be a ton of fun. I don't know how many of you have gone to Gen Con, but one of the restaurants at Gen Con has a number of times over the years had as one of the things you can get for lunch trail rations, which are dried fruit and jerky and hardtack, and they sell those things like hotcakes because people are just so excited to be eating the things listed on their iron rations, right? The grognards in particular. Now, for the restaurant, that's like we bought $1 worth of dried food. We're charging you $17 for it and $4 for it. So it's a great deal for them. But it just shows the investment that people can get on the, you know, for a lot of these games, we're doing a lot with our mind. And the more you can involve your other senses, that's one of the places where props come in. Jason Keeley was talking earlier about you can borrow from other games. You can also borrow from things that aren't games. Back when I lived in a house in Oklahoma where space is cheap, I had a lot of terrain. And while we frequently don't think of it that way, even terrain and miniatures and maps, those are all forms of props. I would frequently troll aquariums because the places that sell stuff for aquariums, because they'll have, here's a bridge with a dead tree on the end. And it turns out that's 3 inches wide. It's pre-painted. It's $5. So I can take that, and we can have an encounter where maybe I draw everything else out in dry erase on a battle mat. But then I put this one thing there, and almost every time I would do something like that, the players would be like, there's a troll under the bridge. The bridge is clearly the most interesting thing on this map. There's got to be.
Troll under it.
We had a group that decided to buy a tavern as their base of operations from a city full of adventurers. So I took one of the maps that Paizo sells, this was before I worked there, that had a big tavern on it, and they said, you have bought this tavern, or your Sharpies, make any changes you guys want. So they were writing what rooms they were taking, and where the horses were, and which was the alchemy lab, and therefore where the fire extinguishers are kept. and you can get Sharpie off those things, but it doesn't happen just randomly. And I just folded up, and it was part of the campaign notes. That prop would be anytime they, we'll have some people over, where are you going to sit them all? We'd fold out the map. Well, we can put him here. No, we don't trust him. He might be able to set someone on fire. That kind of object can really help boost a game. The same thing is true of ships. You've got a naval ship being able to say, here is your ship for a space game, starships. You know, if you're playing a Ghostbusters game, make your own map of a brownstone or a Chinese restaurant. It doesn't matter. And that way you can tell people, we want to get another vehicle. Where are you going to park it?
I use the mats even when it's not combat and there's combat taking place there, just because they set the mood, right? Like, and yes, I work for Paizo, so yes, I have financial incentive to urge you to buy them, but even if I were not working for Paizo, like, the flip mats are great because there is so much detail, and you can choose how much people interact with them, but, like, I was using, I would say, the Bandit Fortress or something, sort of my player's home base, and, like, there's a picture of a couch that, you know, the cartographer just kind of threw in this one room, and, like, my players got really attached to that couch. That was, like, the discussion couch where they would all go and sit in that little room and then fight over who got to sit on the actual couch. And it was, you know, so the visuals really help people. Our imaginations are great, but sometimes a little structure is good.
Sometimes you can get a lot of information that can be hard to keep track of simplified through the use of props. I ran a game where there was a fairly complicated political plot going on during a ball, and people were using, it was a masked ball, and different masks indicated what faction you'd come in from, and of course, a lot of NPCs and player characters were switching masks. So I had just badges that said what mask they were wearing, and everyone just put it in front of them. And if you switched masks, you just have to remember to switch it. And I had nameplates for NPCs, and I would put the masks there, although the NPCs were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, because they didn't know who they were. And it, we did have the moment where someone went up and had forgotten to change their mask. And I'm like, is there anything else you want to do before you start this conversation? No, I'm good. I'm totally good. Great. So I'll go up and I'll make this. And they're like, why would this faction do this? You're an imposter. And everyone could remember what was going on because we had 22-cent cards in front of us to move that information around. For that matter, just things like this. A lot of groups use them, especially if you have multiple characters or if you switch characters, just so you can put on there, instead of Jason Keeley, if he's got Grognar the Dim as his character, and he's got not that you're Dim, you're playing.
Oh, right.
Okay. But it means people will remember that character's name. You can, if you have an illustration of that character, or you pick something that is an illustration of a character, one thing a lot of groups that I play with will do is say, my character looks roughly like this actor, or this character from fiction, or this crayon drawing my daughter did at one point. But the point is some visual element, and it just reminds everyone, I'm not dealing with Jason Keeley, a very erudite and intelligent person. I've got Grognar the Dim, and I will treat him differently when having conversations.
There was a time a few years ago when it became policy that everybody on the creative team had to run games here at PaizoCon, and we had a bunch of people who had never run games at conventions and were nervous about doing it. So we got together to do a bunch of beginner box games. And I don't know how many of you know John Compton. Dude does impressions of other people, and it's a little scary when you see him do an impression of a coworker, because then you know he's got one of you too. But so he came in, and you know, we all had our name tags for, you know, our characters, and he came in and put down a name tag in front of him that said Mark Moreland, and proceeded to play the game as Mark Moreland. And, you know, every time we looked at him, he started laughing, because that was, I don't know if Mark's gotten him back for that one yet.
I ran the Skull and Shackles AP, and one of the big parts of that is you go and you start to get crew, and then you might get a couple other ships, and you get crew for that ship. So we would go, the players would go, and they would go hire some crew members. And what I did, I started by writing down on an index card a couple of names. Here are the people you've hired. And then I kind of, then they were just getting like 10, 12 people at a time. So I was like, oh, everyone's writing their own names down. And then we had it wasn't a corkboard, it was a door to another room that was just covered in names, right? So you're like, oh, okay, some of the start off as the big, because it starts off, you know, you're on the one ship, and I was using those name cards to keep everybody a track of, this is that first mate that doesn't like you, and who's beating you, and putting you in the hot box, or this is the captain, what have you. And then those people died taking them down. But then their crew, and just their names, and they were goofy-ass names, right? It got really silly. One guy was named, they called him Bee Wife, because they saved him from being carried away by a giant bee. And they so but when it came time later on in the game, when it was like, oh, now we have an armada, we've got four ships, who's going to be on what ship, they were able to like, oh, get all the names down, like, well, these four people, that's really good, and here, and then they would assign people get a personality if they, if a PC was like, it became attached to them, they're like, oh yeah, that guy, he really likes whistling, so they would know that little note on that, and so then you could match up, oh, this is your, you know, you're the captain now of this ship, you are the first mate of it, now we have two ships, who do you want on your crew, so it becomes... What's that?
B-wife, always.
No, B-wife. Yeah, so yeah, and it just keeping track of information in a physical way becomes a prop, a way to enhance the game.
Do you want to take any questions?
Yeah.
That sounds good.
So anyone have any questions?
Yes.
Games within a game?
Oh, yeah, like playing, like, poker or even a dice game. Yeah, I mean, like, as long as it, like, doesn't... Because, you know, a game of poker can take a lot of time. In that Western game I was talking about, and a lot of the mechanics of that game had to do with decks of cards. We had lots of decks of cards. So it would be like, we're just going to play, you wanted, this is going to represent your entire evening, but we're going to play one hand of poker. You know, here's your, it's basically draw, five hand. Oh, I've got cheating. Rolled that. Okay, I've succeeded. Here's an extra card. Right? So I can now, oh, I need to make the best five card hand out of my six cards, right? Because I've cheated. Or I'm good at gambling. I have the gambling skill. I get two extra cards, whatever. So like, stuff like that can be really handy. Oh, and, you know, granted, it's often never like hinging, if you don't win this poker game, everybody dies kind of thing. But it's always, well, that's how we maybe get a little extra money and then we can, you know, get a little better guns or what have you,
or you're trying to impress a gambler,
or trying to impress an NPC, exactly, right? And like, oh, or like, or maybe I'll Jessica with a good game, and I'm going to sit in on this too, and then like really f up so that it makes Jessica look better or something like that. You can really make that work. It's just you probably want to avoid it taking up a ton of time.
Yeah.
So simplified dice game rules, that sort of thing.
There it will depend a little bit about taking up time. I ran a second edition D&D game over the course of about a decade that was building towards a war amongst nations. And the characters got to the level where they were leading some of those nations, or at least major factions within them. And in case no one knows, the mass combat rules for second edition and first edition and third and fourth, they're just not that good. As it happens, all of my players really enjoyed the L5R card game, Legend of the Five Rings, which has the cards that represent entire units of people. So when we'd gotten to the point where all of the skirmishing and the little things, the stuff I could do with we did at one point fill a giant table for one siege, right? But we needed the whole war, and I wanted to wrap up that plot line. So I set up an L5R card game where all of the decisions people had made up to this point determined what cards they got to start with, and they all had their hands, and I represented all of the enemy. And we had... I made a unique card for each player character so that they could influence the battle. So this character is famous for saving the day by fireballing people. So I just wrote in the ability, fireball, once per war, you can eliminate one enemy unit. That's it. It doesn't have to be balanced. We're just trying to play fun. But we took an entire weekend where we gamed all Saturday. We all slept at my house. We all got up in the morning, ordered pizza, and gamed the rest of the day. But we held, since it was a month a turn, we had a 3-year war over the course of a weekend where the player characters were crucial to every action. And when it was done, everyone felt like this was not just a narrative decision. I didn't say who win and who lost. They felt like it was not a gimme or a slog, but we had played a game we like in a different format to settle something that is outside of the scope of the regular game. So as long as you know that the thing you're doing is something that people are interested in and it is serving a useful narrative purpose, I think you can actually eat up a lot of time with a game within a game.
Sure, as I would say, as long as all of your players are participating right in that thing, so if like not everyone not necessarily want to play the dice game to impress the whatever, so if like it's something like that that only one or two characters are participating in, then you might want to, you know, keep it pretty short. But like if everyone is doing something, like, you know, or a Jenga tower, everyone's got to cross that bridge, so everyone's going to have to make the pull. Everyone will be invested.
Or either make sure that it's a game that everybody can participate in, like poker, or make sure that it is short and very interesting and suspenseful to watch, right? Like, you can have one character play the GM for whatever, but, like, it can't go on too long, and, like, it needs to at least be interesting. Otherwise, you know, it devolves into everybody else is checking their phone while these two people play, so.
And although there aren't necessarily a lot of options, there are props designed for that sort of thing by game companies. I think it's out of print now, but Wizards of the Coast did Three Dragon Ante, which was a card game, which came with rules for how your 3035 characters could cheat. So you could make a bluff check or a diplomacy check or sleight of hand So you can just play it as a regular game, and it's a good card game, which is important, but you can also play it in character and try things like I cheated to get an extra card, but they were codified rules. Paizo's got the Harrow deck, which has a number of things you can do with it, but the Harrow deck is also an object within the game, and they've got rules for like coming up with someone's fortune using the Harrow deck. It's another good prop in that regard.
Harrow deck's an awesome prop.
Yeah, Harrow deck is a great prop. We have another...
just getting into really short anecdotes and stuff, are there any, you mentioned one was this, are there any other like, skill checks that really, really lend really well that you want to raise for any of those props?
Sleight of hand and Jenga towers.
Okay.
Right, so if you're trying to pick somebody's pocket, it should be a thing that makes you very nervous, and it should be dramatic if you fail. Jenga towers.
This is something that happened in a weekend long LARP that I did with some friends, and it might not translate well to a tabletop game, but someone was a rogue, and what happened was at the beginning of the LARP, she got a list of combinations, right? And as we were going around doing other things, we would just sort of stumble across these boxes in the middle of the woods which had combination locks on them. So she had 12 of them, and she'd have to go through and, that's not the right one. And it might not be that she had one. So there were other groups happening. We're like, well, do you have the green 5 combination yet? No, let me trade you my blue 4 one. And then, you know, you'd be like trading lock-picking tips, I suppose. So I don't know how well that might work if you just sort of like... for one session, or like if there's a point where like at the beginning of a campaign where someone's always going to be picking locks, you can give them a bunch of combinations, and every once in a while just give them one of the combinations maybe, or maybe not, because they might fail, right? So.
This is a really weird specific example, but I worked on the Star Wars role-playing game Wizards of the Coast for 3 editions. And of course, in Star Wars, one of the iconic moments is the trench run. And therefore, frequently adventures cheat and recreate the trench run somehow, right? Because it can't be the trench run. Luke did that. So I had an adventure where there is a giant valley that has a number of giant turbo lasers that will shoot down any ship that tries to escape, and the job of the characters in their starfighters is to fly down this valley and blow up a whole bunch of different things. And I had brought the players to the moment where ready to do that. I had them all make a single attack roll and a single pilot check to determine how well they had done, and then we all went to a... arcade that had skee ball. And so how many quarters you got and how good a score you got determined while throwing the balls at the skee balls or trying to bullseye things determined how much damage you did to the turbo lasers in order to allow the giant transports to escape. And if you'd done a good piloting check, then you could go to someone else's lane and help them if you needed to. And if you've got a good attack number, you got a number of different games to try and get, we would combine all the score, and every time you ever got that little center hole that almost never gets, we just checked off one hole win entirely because you bullseyed it. That was a really weird setup, but everyone got really invested in this narrow, long targeting system with a physical target at the end, and how well their characters had done determined how many tries they got. So yes, people who are better at skee ball did better, but by having pilots able to move back and forth, they were able to think tactically and defeat the valley by playing skee ball as a team. And it worked really, really well, despite being a really odd case that I'm not sure I can apply to anything else.
I've also used for situations where people had to like climb up a castle wall or something that essentially would be an acrobatics check, but it's like, you know... It's trying to replicate something that's actually a really long, involved process. Those little games that have the maze where you're trying to get the little ball. I would have one of those. They would roll their acrobatics check. If they got below a 10, they only got the one shot at it. If they got a 10 or a 11 to a 15, they got 2 shots at it. And if they got above 15, they got 3. But so, you know, they had to sit there balancing the little maze toy, and it was very stressful for them at some point. And very frustrating, because, you know, should be.
Because you mentioned a wall, I'm reminded of one that I did that, again, is very specific, but they were supposed to climb an enormous wall, and it is important to note no character had flight, so everyone had to climb. I, for a while, was in a huge kick on that roll-it post-it note material. I used it for everything I possibly could. I took the basic gray flip mat, and I stuck it to a wall. And I gave everyone a pawn, and I put the material on it, and we stuck it here. And instead of playing on the table, this was the height you had to climb. And viscerally, people that would never have been worried that they were 12 inches laterally from a fall started to freak out as they saw the actual little pawn get higher and higher on the wall because the fall could... The other thing was I had a little base, and if you fell, you ended up wherever your pawn ended up. We would just flick it off, and there were pits and stuff, so you could end up someplace terrible. So it made the whole thing just a more visceral experience that they're seeing the altitude instead of having to imagine it.
This also, from my experience, I've been in games where the GM has empowered the players to bring their own props in and involve it. For example, long game playing over years, one character decided to make their familiar the multi-cat. Cat combined with basically Swiss Army knife, and she would... was very good at crocheting and everything, so every time she would level up, the multi-cat would get another tool, and there. One other character was very good, was the bard, and would reward people who would, he would quote-unquote charm with, like, little candies, or anything like that, so people would want to follow the bard to get the candies, and things like that.
The core idea there that your players may want to get in on the fun too, and that is a great way to bring that other senses element to a game without you, the game master, necessarily having to do all the work, is I think is a good one. It is worth talking to your players to make sure that someone does not create something that's going to eat up half of the game time.
Yeah.
But again, he mentioned in-game feasts. I am not a particularly good cook, but I have gamed with a lot of really good cooks, and sometimes they'd be like, hey, everyone come over and make dinner. I guess I could make, you know, the basilisk empanadas that were mentioned in the last game, and we're like, what are you going to use for a basilisk? Just come over and find out. It turns out jalapeno soaked pork. But again, that was a player getting involved. That's very, very helpful. I guess we're down to our last few minutes.
Yeah.
Do we want to do wrap-up thoughts, or do we have another question we want to hit?
Oh, let's hit one more question.
Okay.
Anybody? I'm
wondering if you have any prop pitfalls, like things that you thought would work and then a prop that did not work out.
Besides that map.
And some of us.
Puzzles are really tricky. My first job in games was doing alternate reality games, which are, you know, puzzle-based a lot of times. And the thing you learn really quickly is that the larger audience you have, the better you can calibrate the difficulty of a puzzle. Because if you've got a million people playing your ARG, you know that every skill set ever needed is going to be in that group, and if it's not in that group, they know where to find it. Somebody knows. I mean, we had one of them. We had this guy who turned out to be an NSA agent helping with the cryptography. So we're like, why are they so fast at this? Turns out, the smaller the group is, the more difficult it is to calibrate puzzles because you don't know, like, especially if it involves some sort of lateral thinking jump or whatever, you can't predict that somebody's going to make that if you only have, it's too small a sample size, essentially. And so you have to be really careful to make sure that you have a backup plan if they just can't solve the puzzle. And you also have to anticipate that, like, don't count it being hard either. Like, if you want this to delay them. So again, back to ARGs, the classic example is the first fully-fledged ARG was a game called The Beast, which was funded as a marketing tool for the movie Artificial Intelligence. And so the team putting it together had crafted this entire narrative of all of these puzzles, and they had like 300 puzzles, and they had them color-coded, the puzzles that were supposed to take a few hours for the players to solve, the puzzles that were supposed to take a day or two, weeks, and even puzzles that they weren't supposed to be able to solve for months or until, you know, the team behind it broke down and gave them more clues, right? And this was going to drive, this was sort of the structure for the narrative. So the player base, which ended up being about 3 million people, which was like an order of magnitude more than they had expected, ended up solving all of the puzzles on the first day. And then, because these games are live, then they had to fly by the seat of their pants for the next 3 months and make everything up hours or mere minutes before it had to go out to the players. So, obviously that's an extreme example, but don't count on a puzzle, like, delaying your players. They might solve it immediately.
Do you have a favorite pitfall, Jason?
I mean, the puzzle thing is definitely a good point. I can't think... The time I used a puppet went okay.
How is that not creepy?
It was creepy. It was meant to be creepy. It was a horror game about creepy puppets for the most part.
Was it a skin wagon?
It was not a skin wagon. Well, I have nothing else to add to that, of course.
Just as a general pitfall, if you know when and where you're going to use a prop, test it. I was running a scenario where there was supposed to be a prismatic field that was partially broken so that what effect was up was changing, and I had a incredibly chintzy child's toy that was supposed to be a little disco disc that I could change the colors, and so I carefully drew a 1-inch grid on it, and I put it in the middle, and the whole point was that I'd be flipping through the colors, and the players would have to take notice, and it just wasn't bright enough. So I've got this little plastic disc, and I put in a 9-volt battery, and I'd click it, and if you sort of put your hands over it, and you shadowed it, and you squinted real hard, you could tell it was red. But it was not cool, it was not helpful, and it was not time-saving. So we ended up just ripping it free, and I would just say, it's red. Okay, great, it's red. Good. So when I had been testing it, I had been doing it in the parking lot at night after I bought it. It was like, blah! Oh yeah, that's great. But it turns out a lot of my friends use solar calculators. We had a gaming space with lots of bright light, and it just was entirely invisible. So if you want a prop to use and work in a specific area, if you've got the opportunity, test the prop. I've also had problems with the... I had a game where I was using the Colossal Dragon from Wizards of the Coast, and we were combining. I was running a game with a friend who had a whole bunch of terrain, so he laid out the terrain for the dragon's tower, and there was no place I could put the dragon without it falling over sideways. So we just couldn't use it. We ended up cutting a piece of paper for its base and just wedging it in and saying, it looks like this, but it's over here. Is that kind of covered for us?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, we've got...
We're supposed to be out 10 in advance.
Oh, yeah? All right, we have 2 minutes. Anybody have a quick question?
Final thoughts.
Player solving versus mechanically solving it by rules. Conflicts between those two.
My personal favorite, if I know the people, is to have what the character does influence how hard it is for the players. So, like the example, you get more skee ball quarters if you're playing a great pilot. That way, both your personal skill and the character's skill are involved. If it's something like crossing the bridge that's a Jenga tower, the character's skill is only sort of relevant. The question is it going to collapse? So that's a dramatic solution where I think it's okay to remove it some. Also, of course, you can say, you know, if the Jenga tower falls over, you have been knocked off, and now you get to try and make a dive check to dive into the water or a climb check to grab onto the edge or whatever. So yeah. I tend to shoot for middle ground, but I never want to make it so that the player's skill totally supplants the character's skill. Because I don't require my wizards to actually know Latin. I don't require my sword fighters to actually be fencers. I want that fantasy element to remain in place.
In general, the more whatever they're doing is influenced by the environment, the less agency I feel like it's okay to give them. So something like, yeah, super rickety old bridge. But, you know, it really depends on the players. It depends on the level they're at. Like, if they're 7th level and they have been investing skill ranks in a particular skill for, you know, 7 levels, make sure they get to use that skill and make sure that it feels meaningful. If it's 1st level, it maybe doesn't matter so much. So, especially if you're a rogue and you get a bazillion skill points, right? It's like, yeah, sure. Yes, I know. Yes, you have knowledge local, whatever. Like, so...
But it's a good question. It's something you should be thinking about when you're deciding how to integrate your props. Cool. I guess that's fine.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.